special thank you to everyone who is tuning in to Lullaby the Fear podcast. If this is your first time and you love the show, then please leave a 5-star rating wherever you listen to podcasts to become a true Fear Cult ambassador. It supports the show for free and motivates me to research deeper cases. Sweet dreams.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
The first simply disappeared, the other two died.
Hello, hello, my pretties. It's your host, Ashley Lana, your non-destructive cult leader, and I have some very exciting news. Lullaby the Fear podcast has been nominated by the Canadian Podcast Awards in the category of Outstanding Debut for a Series. Isn't that exciting? And that deserves a round of applause for you, the listeners, because you're the ones who keep me excited to research for days on end and produce entertainment. So thank you. Thank you so much, Fear Cult. So with that being said, welcome to Lullaby. Richard fucking Ramirez. This is it. This is the case that you voted for, and I spent over 4 weeks pulling all my sources to create tonight's case. There are a lot of guest cameos also in this episode, so listen intently for those voices. I wanted to detail the life of Richard Ramirez as in-depth as I could for a special long episode, and I put in a lot of effort and research into this, so I hope that you'll finish feeling like you understand him more as a serial killer. Because you thought you didn't like him before? Oh, just you wait. Just you wait. This, of course, is a wow episode, a worst of the worst. And the main source for this episode is from the incredible biography titled The Night Stalker, written by Philip Carlo, and he spent over 100 hours sitting with Richard Ramirez at San Quentin's death row. And I feel like I have spent over 100 hours just studying Richard Ramirez. And I have. You know what? I actually have. I have watched a plethora of documentaries, which usually run at minimum 40 minutes an episode, right? I read the Night Stalker biography. I read the Ultimate Richard Ramirez Collection, the newspaper articles, and the entire Supreme Court of California, The People versus Richard Ramirez. So yes, I have studied over 100 hours of Richard Ramirez. And I am excited to give you this haunting telling of the Night Stalker. So get comfortable, because sweet dreams are made of these. The following story contains subject matter involving graphic descriptions of rape, crimes against children, mental and physical abuse, necrophilia, and murder. Please take into consideration that some topics may be disturbing for some listeners. Listener discretion is advised. One day, when Richard was spending time with his cousin Mike, he went to the fridge to grab a drink. He opened the door and his eyes fell upon the item that would change his life forever. A .38 caliber pistol. Feeling confused, Richard asked Mike why he had a gun in the fridge. His cousin casually responded that he might be using it later, and it had to be cold. Some time had passed, and Mike's wife, Jessie, had come home from grocery shopping. She immediately wasn't in a good mood.
Miguel, could you come unload some of these groceries with me?
A lot of stuff here. How much was everything?
Maybe you'd have an idea on how much I spent on food if you got a job and pitched in.
I don't need your fucking attitude. Don't come barging in through those doors and immediately start bitching and nagging at me.
If you helped me out around the house more, maybe I wouldn't have to. Don't you fucking walk away from me while I'm talking to you.
Shut up. I'm sick and tired of you constantly always on my ass about everything.
When will you start taking your family seriously? I cannot be the only one who does everything around here while you're lying around smoking pot and doing nothing. I'm serious.
Mike stomped by Jessie and opened the fridge. He reached in and retrieved the pistol.
Oh, fuck, Mike. What do you plan to do with that thing?
If you don't stop fucking complaining and whining, I'll shoot you in the face. I'll kill you.
We both know you won't do that, because then you'd have to get a job. Actually, you know what? Shoot me. I dare you. Fucking shoot me.
At point-blank range, Mike shot his wife Jessie in the face. The smell of gunpowder and the sound of her two young children crying filled the house. Richard watched in shock as he watched the body drop to the floor and blood started spurting from the wound. He didn't know how to respond. He had never seen anyone murdered before.
You don't ever say you saw this. You understand? Now go home.
This is the horrific true story of the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez.
To understand the evolution of Richard Ramirez, we're going to have to go back to the life of his parents. Richard's father, Julian Tapia Ramirez, was the second born of eight children on February 16, 1927 in Caramago, Mexico. His mother, Roberta, passed away when he was 12 years old, and Julian's father was named Jose, and he was known as a truly intimidating man who would both physically and mentally punish his children when they acted up. Julian would get beat by both his father and grandfather on a regular basis. For example, if Julian ever slept in or talked back, then his grandfather would tie him to a tree and whip him with a rope. When Julian was 14 years old, he stood up to his father and grandfather. He took his own belt and stood on the ground, and he defended himself, telling him that he would no longer be hurt by them, by anyone. And he swore that he would never hurt his own family in the future. It was when Julian was 14 years old that he met the love of his life, who would soon become the mother of Richard Ramirez. Mercedes Munoz was born in Colorado, United States, where she held an American citizenship. Her family moved to Caramago, Mexico, when World War II came to the United States. Her family didn't want her brothers to get drafted. Julian would eventually get drafted into the military, and he learned how to shoot guns and use tactical skills. Not long into his time, he caught scarlet fever that prevented him from being able to serve in the Army. Once he returned, he asked for Mercedes' hand in marriage and confessed that he could not live without her. And on August 9th, 1948, the couple got married. Mercedes was an American citizen, and she felt safer living in El Paso, Texas, to raise her family. While Julian was waiting for the approval of his citizenship, the couple moved to El Paso. He began working in a clothing factory while Mercedes continued to work as a housekeeper. In the 1940s, the American government was performing nuclear bomb testing in Los Alamos, New Mexico. The radioactive material would break down and be carried into the winds of El Paso. At the time, the devastating effects of nuclear fallout on the human body were not common knowledge. Radioactive material decays, and it gets released into the atmosphere that can directly kill living cells, or it can cause genetic mutations in DNA. In El Paso, the water supply and animal livestock were affected. The rate of birth defects, such as undeveloped organs, mental disabilities, and missing limbs, substantially increased in the area. Soon after, Mercedes gave birth to their oldest son, Ruben Ramirez. When Ruben was born, he had large growths on the back of his neck. The poor baby had to sleep in an incubator for months. The doctors were confident that Ruben would not survive his condition and that the family even had to call a priest to read him his final rites. The Catholic family prayed for their baby to recover, and miraculously he did. 11 months after the birth of their first son, the couple had their second child, another boy named Jose, short for Joseph. Joseph was diagnosed with Collier's disease. This is a rare bone disorder that causes extreme pain in the bones due to compression, causing the bones to curve. This was from the radioactivity in the area. For the rest of his life, Joseph would have to undergo painful surgeries to allow him to walk on his own, and eventually he would lose his leg. It was in 1952 when Julian got deported for working without a citizenship. Despite his wife and two children having American citizenship, the border police demanded that the entire family got sent back to Mexico with all of their belongings. The family were able to live at Mercedes' mother's home in Juarez, and Julian immediately began searching for employment. He met up with an old friend who worked as a police officer. He told him that he could recommend him for a job as an officer, and he accepted. It didn't take long for Julian to become the department's lead ammunitions instructor, to teach the other officers how to handle and shoot a firearm, a skill he acquired in his time in the military. During this time, Mercedes gave birth to a baby boy, their third son, who they named Robert. In early 1954, Leon acquired his American citizenship, and the family moved back to El Paso, Texas. The Ramirez family was happy living in their small home. Julian was working at the Santa Fe Railroad as a laborer. The hard work resulted in him having to work out of town for weeks on end. Mercedes knew that she had to start working to provide for their family, so she hired a housekeeper. In 1955, Mercedes began working at Tony Lama's boot factory, mixing toxic color chemicals for dyeing the boots. She would often feel lightheaded and nauseous, and at the time, there were no APA ventilation or mask regulations. This was very dangerous, and luckily for the family, when they had their fourth child, a daughter, who they named Ruth, she was born happy and healthy with no complications. Neither parent spoke English, so they wanted their children to learn the language so they could have every opportunity for success in America. Reuben, Robert, and Ruth all developed the quick temper that their father Julian displayed whenever he got upset. Joseph was more of the sensitive one due to his bone impairments. His limping made him a target for bullying in school, and Joseph's siblings were always there to defend him. They would hit and throw objects whenever they were angry, and this was a common Ramirez family trait. In late 1959, Mercedes became pregnant again, this time with her final child. The pregnancy was complicated from the start as a result of all the toxic fumes she was inhaling at her job. Mercedes' body was rejecting the formation of the fetus inside of her. She had to get multiple injections just to keep the baby from dying. Eventually, her doctor informed her that if she didn't quit her job at the boot factory, then she would lose her child. And without hesitation, Mercedes quit. Ricardo Leyva Munoz Ramirez was born on the leap year day of February 29, 1960. Ruth Ramirez recalled Richard being her favorite brother. Together, they would play dress-up, and the siblings loved spending time together. He was always dancing and laughing, and he was never a problem toddler. At school, Reuben and Robert soon became the rebellious two of the five children. The two were enrolled in slow learning classes, and their grades started to slip, and they cared more about skipping class and fighting. They were very aggressive, and Richard's sister Ruth recalls being hit by her older brothers frequently. If it were not for her brothers, Joseph and Richard, she would have been beat more during her teens. The oldest, Ruben Ramirez, was the initial cause of all the stress put on their father, Julian. Ruben was always getting into fights with the other kids at school, plus his siblings. Julian would punish Ruben frequently, but this never changed his behavior. Their father would only punish his children when they acted up. Soon his internal stress and anger, he'd begin releasing upon himself to prevent hurting his children. The family moved to a barrio in central El Paso on Lado Street. It was located close to Cordova Cemetery. Richard's mother had hired a housekeeper for the children and the home while both of them were working long hours. Julian started working out of town for longer periods of time while working on the railroad. Without the parental supervision, the older boys, Reuben and Robert, developed a more delinquent behavior. Together, they would hang out with the other troubled teens, burglarizing houses and sniffing glue to get high. Reuben began hanging out with their older cousin, Miguel, who was more commonly known as Mike. Cousin Mike would become the pivotal influence of the future crimes of Richard Ramirez. In 1962, when Richard was 2 years old, he asked the family housekeeper if she could turn on the radio so he could dance to the music. Richard loved to dance. It was his favorite pastime. And Socorro, the housekeeper, denied his request and continued to watch television in the other room. Being a very independent child from the start, Richard decided to turn it on himself. He walked into the bedroom and looked up at the radio that sat high on the large dresser. Scoping out his options, the two-year-old Richard opened the bottom drawer and used it as a step to the next one. Scaling the wooden dresser, his body weight had caused the entire structure to fall onto him, rendering him unconscious. His head was cut open and started bleeding. It was over 15 minutes before he was discovered. Young Richard was taken to the hospital and diagnosed with a concussion. He received 30 stitches. One night, the Ramirez house got a phone call from the police. Reuben had been arrested with his cousin Mike, and Julian was informed that his oldest son and nephew had stolen a vehicle. Reuben had brought shame to the Ramirez family, and Julian would have none of that. He began hitting Reuben at the police station and proceeded to beat him more once they got home. Richard recalled crying all night, terrified of upsetting his father from then on out. Not so soon after, Reuben was arrested again for breaking and entering into a home in the area. Richard recalled his sister cuddling with him all night as they listened to the punishment carry on. As Reuben and Robert Ramirez grew up, they only got into more trouble. This caused the diabetic father, Julian, to become more stressed, and he began drinking whenever his sons acted up. Their father's pent-up rage caused him to hurt himself. Whenever something didn't go his way, he would hit himself. The siblings remember a time when Julian was fixing the sink and he couldn't. Filling with anger, he picked up a hammer and started beating himself over the head, causing him to bleed. In 1963, Richard witnessed his father attempting to fix the filter on the car. When the part would not fit, his father flew into a rage and started throwing his head into the side of the house, causing blood to run down his face. This made all the children feel very scared and uncomfortable. Joseph Ramirez recalled all the children running away. Richard enjoyed amusing himself rather than playing with other children. His favorite person to play with, though, was his sister Ruth. And one day in 1965, when Richard was 5 years old, he went to a nearby park to find Ruth. He seen her on the swing set, and he began smiling from ear to ear as he ran up to her. The edge of her seat struck him in the head, and he passed out bleeding. Another head injury to Richard Ramirez, a common factor between serial killers. When Richard was in the fifth grade, he had his first of many epileptic seizures, on an average of 10 to 12 a month. In class, he fell hard to the floor and began shaking. His mother was called to the school, and she was informed of the incident. The school nurse told Mercedes that she needed to take Richard to the hospital so that he could be examined for injuries and prescribed seizure medication. His mother didn't go to the hospital, she just took him home. And the very next day, Richard had another seizure. It was then Mercedes took him to the hospital and he was diagnosed as an epileptic, but still not prescribed medication. Ruth remembers after the second incident, Richard began zoning out frequently, and he would stare up into space for 15 minutes at a time. There's the head injuries. So Richard suffered many of them, and probably even more than were recorded, because he had so many epileptic breaks where he'd fall to the floor and smack his head. Now let's discuss how this affected Richard. As we've discussed before, childhood sustained head injuries are one of the most common traits among serial killers, and Richard was diagnosed with an injury to the temporal lobe. So like the function of the temporal lobe, it's the processing of emotions to understand language and visual perception and the memory. So those are just some of the things. And I read this article titled "Neuropsychiatry of Frontal Lobe Dysfunction in Violent and Criminal Behavior, a Critical Review." And it was by the Department of Neurology at the McLean Hospital. So the objective was to establish a link between the frontal lobe dysfunction and violent and criminal behaviors. Case studies dating back to 1835 report the onset of antipersonality disorder after a temporal lobe injury. And it was observed that serial killers had poor impulsive control and explosive aggressive outbursts. They had lack of intrapersonal sensitivity, this increased sadistic sexual craving, like verbal lewdness, like lack of inappropriate sensitivity, and altered religious views. However, that last one I will argue, because let's face it, it's 2022, we're all different, we're all great, we're all beautiful. Can I get an amen? Okay, moving on. So, as you all know, I love my medical journals. And it's funny because my problem, and also probably one of my biggest strengths with researching particularly, is that I cannot stop reading sources. I love it. And I found another titled "Brain Scans of Incarcerated Men Reveal Reduced Gray Matter in Homicide Offenders" by Jack Wang. What the heck is gray matter, Ashley? Well, thank you for asking. So gray matter is the pinkish-gray colored brain tissue, and it's responsible for the processing of information and enables an individual's emotions, memory, and control movements. Scientists examined the brains of over 800 homicide prisoners and discovered that they had substantially less gray matter in their brain when compared to those involved in other offenses. That was a good read. I think I'm going to post on the website because it's very informative. All right, aside from the head injuries, Richard was doing well in school at this point, and teachers recalled him working very hard, and he wanted to do well, and he was always trying to make people smile. He wasn't like his older brothers. Like, he wasn't getting into trouble. He wasn't starting fights. Reuben, however, was a little shit disturber, And he was the drama, and he was always influencing his brother Robert when they were growing up. And this is also when Miguel comes into the picture. Now Miguel, who I will from now on refer to as Cousin Mike, is an issue. He needs to be discussed. So Mike had a hostile anger that had the community scared of him. And he will have such an influence on Richard, even though Richard denies it. But when I mention Cousin Mike, I want you to really pay attention because he was actually the first dramatization that introduced you to this episode. Because at this point, Richard is about between five and seven years old. And yeah, and his older brother is hanging out with his cousin, Cousin Mike. So notice how Reuben is a problem child, but keeps getting arrested whenever fucking Mike is around. Now, Mike is their first cousin, and he is the son of Julian's sister, Victoria. And I'll get more into Mike as we go along, because he is just a bag full of cracked out cats. I want to tell you about Cousin Mike. Okay, well, moving on. The story is about to turn dark. When Richard was in the seventh grade, everything began to change. He stopped paying attention in class, and his grades fell drastically. Reuben and Robert were in the slow learners class at Bowie Junior High School. Their teacher was named Frank McMahon, who was a pedophile who would perform sexual acts on the children in the school's washrooms. Although he molested many of his students, he specifically targeted Reuben and Robert. When their mother and father were not home, Frank McMahon would go to the Ramirez home to sexually assault them. Reuben Ramirez recalled that he knew what he was doing with his teacher was wrong, but it felt good, so why stop? Robert Ramirez recalled that at times, once Frank McMahon was finished abusing them at their home, he would take them back to his house and continue. Reuben admitted it was a good way to stay on the teacher's good side. Their parents had no idea that the abuse was going on, so it continued for years. Both brothers do not know if Frank McMahon would sexually abuse Richard, even though Robert and Richard did admit there was a lot of times where Richard would come over. But he would not have been surprised if Richard was sexually assaulted. When Richard was on death row, he was asked about it. He said that he didn't remember and probably just repressed it. Richard did recall seeing a pedophile that lived in the area where he lived, and he witnessed him shove a candle into the boy's rectum and remembers the boy screaming. Once the man started sodomizing the boy, Richard said that that's when he left. Reuben and Robert's involvement with the wrong side of the law had gotten so bad that the Ramirez family had to start selling their possessions to pay for the lawyers. Julian knew that his nephew Mike was one of the main influences in their son's lives. But no matter how much he pleaded, he could not change his son's behaviors. In 1965, Cousin Mike was drafted into the army and served in Vietnam. This took some weight off Julian's shoulders, hoping that now his sons wouldn't be so negatively influenced. Richard started becoming more introverted and isolated the older he got. His sister Ruth explained that when Richard was kicked off the school's football team, it changed something inside of him, as if he felt like he wasn't good enough anymore. Richard would try so hard to keep his father happy, but his father was getting so upset about the smallest things. Now he wasn't even good enough for a football team, the one thing that he was so proud of. He was proud of how fast he was, and he had the fastest legs in the entire school, which made him an excellent quarterback. And during his final game, he had a seizure on the field. The coach told him that he didn't want to take any responsibility for his health and kicked him off, no questions asked. If Richard was prescribed medication, he would have been able to continue to play, but no one was aware of this. When Cousin Mike had returned from the Vietnam War, he was a decorated war hero with four medals. While in the war, his Green Beret platoon of 20 men got surrounded by the enemy. He and another man were the only ones who made it out alive. He suffered PTSD and never went to therapy, which did affect him greatly in the end. It is unknown if Mike was a psychopath prior to going to war, but when he came back, he was much darker than before. Richard viewed Mike as a male hero figure that he missed in his life. Mike had stories that most couldn't even tell, at least admit to. Mike was married with a strong woman who could handle his temper. Her name was Jessie, and the couple had two young sons. Mike would tell Richard of his war tales, and that he was proud that he killed so many soldiers in battle. He was even more proud of his 29 murders that he committed at the same time. Mike explained to 12-year-old Richard that the Viet Cong believed that no one would go to heaven if they lost a portion of their body. Some of the American soldiers would purposely mutilate the bodies before death, and it was common to see American soldiers with necklaces of human ears and other body parts as trophies. Mike had 8 shrunken heads that he brought home from Vietnam. He claimed that he used them as pillows while he was stationed. The two cousins would always spend time together, taking long drives and smoking marijuana. They discussed how the rich Caucasians needed to be humbled and their wealth should be shared, which is why Mike and Richard's brother Reuben would steal. Something his father was very against was his youngest son spending so much time with his nephew, but Richard was incorrigible. Richard's older brothers had moved out at this point, and this left Richard feeling the brewing wrath of his father at home. He wanted to spend little to no time at home, so he would always have a sleeping bag nearby so that he could sleep in the Cordova Cemetery, where he said that he found peace at night. Richard had learned early on how to deal with firearms because of his father's training. Mike wanted to perfect the skill and teach him how to kill. He also began teaching him how to pick locks, use stealth, and the cover of darkness to get into any location. All it took was practice. Mike showed him the art of guerrilla hand-to-hand combat and how to kill a person with only their bare hands. Richard admitted that he didn't like fighting, but he knew the skills were important if he wanted to continue his life as a thief. Later in his mid-teens, Richard would drop out of school and take martial arts at the local karate school. He had given up all aspirations of a good career. He just wanted to live free, do drugs, and steal. Mike would brag to Richard about all the Vietnamese women that he would rape, torture, mutilate, and then murder. It became real to Richard when Mike would show him dozens of Polaroid photographs taken of him doing those atrocities to his victims. Crying women were forced on their knees to perform oral sex on the soldiers, and specifically Mike. Mike would hold a gun to their head as someone would take a photo. Other photos would reveal Mike holding up the decapitated head of the woman he had just abused. 12-year-old Richard was getting sexually aroused by these photographs. He had seen the power and the control that his cousin had over these women, and he discovered that he, at an early age, had a lust for BDSM and violent non-consensual sex, and he would begin masturbating, thinking of the decapitated heads in the photographs. What Mike would tell Richard cemented into his psyche. Killing gave you a high that was godlike. You got to control who lived and who died. You were God. Being raised a devout Catholic, Richard knew that these feelings were wrong and that no human should do such crimes. But if it were so wrong, then why was he aroused by it? Richard began thinking of other religious options and started becoming interested in worshiping Lucifer, because surely he would agree. One day, when Richard was spending time with Mike, he went to the fridge to grab a drink. He opened the door and his eyes fell upon an item that would change his life forever. Sometime later, Mike's wife Jessie came home from shopping, and the couple broke into a fight regarding Mike not having a job to support the family. When Jessie would not stand down, Mike shot her in front of Richard and their 2 young children. Richard never told anyone about the murder of Jessie. Leaving the scene, he was extremely upset but never sought therapy. Mike was arrested and sent to jail. And from behind bars, Mike called Richard's father and asked him to go to the house and retrieve some jewelry. Leon, Mercedes, and Richard then went to Mike's apartment. Mercedes was told to stay in the car, but Richard was supposed to go with his father. Upon entering, Richard recalled the smell of dried blood. He and his father then immediately seen the large ring of dried blood where Jesse's body had fallen. Richard explained the whole experience as a mystical one. He was touching her belongings and felt as though that he was in contact with her. His father found the bullet that had killed Jessie and kept it. The two examined it, enamored by its destructive power. Cousin Mike was taken to trial for the murder of his wife. His defense pleaded temporary insanity, and the jury felt sympathy for him for being a war hero that never had therapy. The prosecution argued that Mike killed his wife in cold blood and should be sent to prison, not a mental hospital, where he could be released whenever the doctors deemed ready. Mike was found innocent by reason of insanity and sent to the Texas State Mental Hospital. Richard, while on death row, said, quote, "I've always been fascinated with serial killers and crime, murder, and death since I was 12, 13 years old." It's clear that his cousin Mike had a direct influence on the evolution of the future. Richard told author Philip Carlo, quote, "I'm not blaming my cousin for anything. I want that clear." After the murder of Jessie, that is when Richard drastically began to change and the family noticed it. He became even more quiet and started to rebel. He stopped caring about school even more. He stopped caring about his hygiene and spent all day and night smoking marijuana. Richard started binging extreme horror movies and reading graphic novels, where he would imagine that he was the killer. His favorite book was titled In Cold Blood, which was the story about the shotgun murders of the Cutter family in Holcomb, Kansas. He always listened to heavy metal music before. However, now he started listening to music that specifically described rebelling and the demons in hell. Richard took everything about the music literally and started trying to relate it with his meaning of life. At this time, Richard began reading more about Jack the Ripper. He was fascinated about the concept of stalking someone at night and pouncing on them and killing them in cold blood. In 1972, his brother Reuben had developed a heroin addiction at the age of 20. Reuben needed more money to support the addiction, so he moved to Los Angeles, California, and began working odd jobs. Reuben began hanging out with a bad crowd, specifically at the Los Angeles Greyhound bus terminal. He was married to a woman from El Paso named Susanna, and together the couple had a son named Juan. At night, Reuben Ramirez would break into upper-class homes and steal anything of value to sell to the neighborhood fences to make quick cash. Reuben took everything he learned from his cousin Mike and his own experiences to become a very stealthy criminal. He was a professional thief at the age of 20. He would steal 7 days a week and sell to fences at the LA bus station. He ran with a group of Mexican-American burglars who jumped the 96 districts of Los Angeles to prevent being caught. It was common knowledge that the different police departments did not share information among each other, which gave criminals the upper hand. When Richard was 12 to 13 years old, he traveled to Los Angeles to stay with Reuben and meet his newborn nephew, Juan. Richard's father was extremely hesitant, knowing the behavior of his oldest. But Richard looked up to his brother, Reuben. He seen him as independent and that he stood up to his father, and that's what he craved himself. Richard loved the new city, the tall buildings, the ocean, and the beautiful women. He couldn't believe the wealth that Los Angeles had, and he told himself that the only way he would be able to acquire it would be to steal it. The thought excited him, aroused him. Richard would tag along with Reuben and break into homes, and soon Richard was breaking and entering houses alone at the age of 13 years old. He found it exhilarating to be in a person's home, especially if they weren't there just to learn the layout. He would fantasize about coming back to the house later and tying the woman up in her bed and raping her inside of her own home. As a child, he craved that feeling of full power and control. Richard knew what he was doing was wrong. It was against the Catholic religion that he was raised, but that didn't stop him. Reuben helped him master the art of lockpicking and disarming all brands of house alarms. He instructed him to look out for motion sensors, dogs, and to stay away from gravel. Always wear gloves, and specifically, where to hide in a house. When Richard went back to El Paso, he was on his last limb with his father. Because he had given up on his grades, his father was constantly yelling at him. Richard was sleeping more and more at the Cordova Cemetery, where he found peace alone. Late at night, Richard began honing his skills with a gun. And in the past, his father, as well as his cousin Mike, would take him out hunting and taught him how to shoot. Now that he was more independent, he would enjoy hunting rabbits, birds, coyotes, and other small creatures on his own. He recalled later practicing his stealth capabilities on creatures with the most sensitive hearing. If he could sneak up on a rabbit, a human was no problem. Afterwards, he would skin and gut the animals. Richard loved seeing the blood and sticking the blade into their bodies, the sounds, the breathing coming to a halt, and of course, the power. He only imagined what it felt like to perform these acts on a human. Ruth Ramirez had moved out of the family's home and married a Mexican-American man named Roberto Alva. Roberto was obsessed with sex and demanded it from her at every waking hour. When the two would fight, Richard would leave and break into neighbors' houses, simply for practice. Roberto Alva, Ruth's husband, was an obsessed peeping Tom. He soon began introducing Richard to these acts and would teach him to observe people secretly from afar. This carried on for months until Ruth found out. She was horrified that her husband was doing this with her baby brother. Ruth demanded that they stop or she was going to divorce Roberto. He apologized, but they secretly continued. And when Ruth discovered a couple months later, she broke up with Roberto and he moved out. Ruth said this about her brother Richard, quote, "My brother never slept. He was up all night, all the time. And he was one of those people who functioned on only a few hours of sleep. He'd watch television or he'd go out somewhere. He just never slept. What Richard was doing was breaking into homes, stealing and practicing his stealth and spying on unknown women. Richard was also now experimenting with hallucinogens like LSD, peyote, and mushrooms. When he was on these drugs, he detailed how he imagined what it was like hunting, like a movie monster ready to pounce on his prey. If the moon was out and the fog was low, he was in his element. In 1975, when Richard was 15 years old, he picked up a job at the Holiday Inn as a caretaker, and the teenager enjoyed lusting over the women who stayed there. And while cleaning their rooms, he would imagine sexual bondage with them, and then he would masturbate. Richard recalled how the curtains were never fully kept closed by the patrons, and he was able to sit outside and watch a couple go about their nightly activities. One time, while waiting in an elevator, two teens his age entered. Richard turned to the girls and told one of them that she was very pretty. The girls giggled and told their parents that a worker was trying to flirt with them, and Richard was then told to apologize and never do it again. After 3 months, he was trusted with a master key to the hotel rooms. He took his new power and used it to enter the bedrooms at night when the guests were sleeping. He would lurk around the room and stand over the edge of the bed, watching them sleep. He would note the movements, the breathing, and where to tie them up if they awoke. It was all research for him to become the Night Stalker. Of course, soon he would have to progress. The petty peeping and thefts were losing their thrill. Richard decided that now was the time to advance. One night, he noticed a woman alone from the window. He had seen her ready to shower, so he creeped into the room using his key and snuck up behind the woman. As she tried to scream, Richard took her to the floor and shoved a pair of her underwear into her mouth. Richard tied her up and began attempting to rape the poor woman. As he was about to penetrate her, the woman's large husband entered the room. His eyes went wide seeing a 15-year-old boy attempting to rape his wife. He lunged at Richard and beat him unconscious. The husband untied his wife and called the police. Richard was taken to the hospital, where he received 30 stitches to the inside of his mouth and had also been diagnosed with another concussion. Richard pleaded with his family, convincing him that he was innocent and that the woman had come on to him. Ruth and their mother believed him. The couple that Richard had attacked had lived outside of the state and didn't want to deal with the court, so they did not press charges, and Richard was released. It was now 1977, and after only 4.5 years in the mental hospital, Cousin Mike was released. Immediately, Richard began spending all of his time with his cousin. Mike didn't change at all, and he continued bragging of his crimes in Vietnam and encouraging Richard's criminal activity. This was when Mike taught Richard to read the stars as a map, so whenever he stalked the night, he always knew where he was going. Richard now had the nickname Dedos, meaning fingers. He was known for stealing anything that wasn't nailed down, and it made Mike proud. Mike still had photos of him torturing women, which of course he continued to flash around. Mike even remarried soon after his release. At 16 years old, Richard began wearing only black to camouflage in the night while burglarizing homes in El Paso. At 17 years old, he had fully considered his cousin Mike to be his new father. Mike had taught him, quote, "You never know when you'll have to provide for yourself. Kill or be killed. You have to always be prepared. After all, life is living in the jungle. It's a fucking dog-eat-dog world, and if you don't eat first, you get eaten." Richard is an enigma wrapped in a mystery, cased in a shell that's double-dipped in a vat of personal problems. His only friends were his brother Reuben and his sister Ruth. Well, I guess his mom too. He loved his mom. He loved his mom. I will say that right now. And his cousin Mike. And this was by choice, because many neighbors and acquaintances in El Paso had nothing bad to say about him. They recalled him as being quiet but very friendly. Now I'm going to play devil's advocate here. The whole, he was so nice and friendly. He seemed like such a nice person. He just had the quirks. This means nothing to me as a criminal researcher, okay? The whole, he seems like such a nice guy syndrome is how serial killers are successful. Intelligent criminals, they don't want to get caught. So if they act suspicious and don't utilize their charm and manipulation in one form of another, they're gonna last a long time. Like Richard Ramirez. Ugh, fucking Ted Bundy. I hate Ted Bundy. Newsflash, if you didn't know, I hate Ted Bundy. John Wayne Gacy, Jeffrey Dahmer, Albert Fish, Edmund Kemper, and Gary Ridgway, like the list goes on. These criminals got away with their crimes for so long because no one believed that they were capable of it, because they were so friendly with their little quirks. Because Richard was quiet, friendly, and attractive to most people, he was a good-looking dude. Before he started killing people and being a really bad criminal, like, he had some game. But he chose to isolate himself. That's something that I really want to point out. He wasn't bullied necessarily. Like, there was occasionally some people that would bully him in like the schoolyard. But other than that, it was like he was just quiet and did his own thing. Nobody really disliked Richard Ramirez. He was just this isolated creature from the start by choice. He wasn't this big player who was trying to sleep with everybody. And it's because the sex that he wanted that aroused him, he knew that legally he couldn't get. But he did get a girlfriend. In 1977, when Richard would have been 17 years old, he started secretly seeing a 13-year-old girl named Nancy Avila. She openly says that she was the one that approached him. So when she was 13, she began thinking about Richard secretly at night sexually. And Nancy lived across the street from him in El Paso. One day, she just can't repress her feelings for him anymore. Like, her Catholic parents would have freaked out if they knew that she was having all these impure thoughts about this older boy. But the crazed Latin fever just starts peaking the thermometer, baby, and she just has to have herself some Richard Ramirez. So Nancy finds him in the phone book, and she calls him up, and the two, they talk all night, every week, for a little bit, close to a month. Yeah, and then Richard asks, "Hey, do you want to meet up?" And Nancy explained that the consensual plan was for Richard to take her virginity at the Flamingo Hotel. La-di-da. So Nancy explained that finally, when they were alone, they started making out, removing their clothes. And then when the moment was about to happen, Richard couldn't get an erection. And she said that he was very patient and he was gentle, but it didn't happen. Like, he wasn't upset, she wasn't upset, but they didn't have sex. So they tried again a week later, and Houston to Mission Control, we have a successful lunar landing. So Nancy and Richard, they started secretly having a relationship, but due to their age gap, they couldn't tell anyone. And they started having sex regularly at the cemetery and all these like hotels. But Richard's mother, Mercedes, she actually found out, and she warned him, was like, "Richard, you need to be easy with this one because this could be bad." And he's like, "It's all good, Mom, I don't love her." So Nancy, she clarified that Richard never at any point made her feel uncomfortable. And she admitted that she fell in love with him and she thought that he loved her, but he didn't. And as time went on, she wanted to spend more time with him, and he wasn't about that life. And he said, like, "I'm moving from El Paso and I want to move to Los Angeles." And this was in 1978, so a year later, so he would have been 18. They broke up. She said that it devastated her because she really loved him. But Richard didn't want to give her more of his time, and he wanted to fulfill his murderous fantasies and have sex that way. Now, in February 1978... 18-year-old Richard, he traveled the 16-hour Greyhound to permanently live in Los Angeles, California. And he was making money by breaking into homes in the night and selling marijuana during the day. And the money was used to maintain his cocaine addiction. And he had an S&M porn addiction, and he was sleeping with sex workers. That was pretty much his life. And then Richard occasionally hung out with his brother Ruben and his cousin Mike. He would have hung out with his brother Robert, but big family Ramirez surprise, he was in prison. But I'm not getting into that. Richard entered this transition in his life where he really enjoyed the isolated solitude in Central City, LA, and what the local gangs referred to this place called as Skid Row. Now, Richard said in interviews that he did not care for people, and he didn't blame society for his problems. He just preferred isolation. Now, Richard was raking in and stealing about $1,500 a week. He was stealing cars to sleep in. He would then ditch them a couple days later so he wasn't getting caught. And between 1978 and 1984, he was arrested multiple times for drug possession, auto theft, and breaking and entering. So he had a criminal record. But I'll explain later that police districts at this time, they did not help each other out, which is how he was able to just fly free for the longest time. Specifically in 1981, when Richard was 21 years old, he was arrested in Pasadena twice for auto theft. Remember this. Hint, hint. There will be a test after this episode. So his diet consisted of candy and drugs, which started the whole plateau of his teeth going from eh to ugh. And he started growing abscesses under his teeth that were filled with infected pus. If you haven't seen a picture of Richard Ramirez's teeth, Google it. Do it right now. I'll give you a moment. But it can't be that long because this is a podcast and it's already a long episode. So I'm moving on. So his mouth was just filled with infection and it gave him his famous halitosis. And that's smart words for bad breath. Every victim that survived would say this guy had the most distinctive bad breath, which helped catching him. So no matter how much sex he was having with women, he couldn't feel that sadistic lust that he craved. And Richard wanted to conquer women in their homes by force and wanted to make them bleed, and he wanted to take their last breath with his own hands. He never fully understood why. He didn't know why he felt this way. He just needed to associate violence with sex in order to be satisfied. And this is because he needs that power and that control because he felt like he didn't have it growing up. All right. So in later interviews, he said, quote, "A serial killer comes about by circumstances. And like a recipe, poverty, drugs, child abuse, and these things, you know, are, they contribute to a person, to a person's frustration and anger. And at some point in life, he explodes." End quote. Congratulations, Richard. You were able to deduce yourself. So all those factors are exactly why he felt that he had to turn into this monster, which is known as the Night Stalker. Let's continue. In late 1978, Richard started using PCP. And this is known to produce a syndrome that mimics schizophrenia in humans with no prior psychiatric diagnosis. One night, while stalking the downtown streets, Richard struck up a conversation with an attractive young woman. The woman was interested in purchasing some hallucinogens from Richard. He told her that he had some, but they would have to go back to her apartment to try it. As Richard and the woman got high on drugs, he wanted to engage in sex. She refused and told him that she was a lesbian. Deep down, the rejection he felt created this lust-filled rage that bubbled inside of him. It was 3 a.m., and he wasn't going back to his hotel until he was satisfied. Playing innocent, Richard casually escorted himself out of the apartment. He instead snuck up to the roof and climbed down the fire escape to peer through her window. He watched her. This is exactly like his fantasies. She had no inkling of what he was about to do to her. Crouched down, he simply watched her turn off the lights and fall asleep. Creeping in through the window, he ambushed the woman's body. He gagged her and tied her up, then aggressively raped her. This was the first time that Richard had sexually took a poor victim by force and saw it through to the end. He left feeling godlike and only craving more. As Richard lay in his rundown room of the 14th floor of the Cecil Hotel, he replayed the entire event in his head as he masturbated in the dark lighting, listening to heavy metal. He pondered to himself what God would think. Being raised a Catholic, obviously he'd be sent straight to hell for his actions. Then it struck him. When he was younger, he started thinking about Lucifer. He decided to turn to the Dark Lord, the fallen angel, the one who would welcome his actions into the afterlife. Richard had thought about turning to Satan years ago, but never committed to the concept until now. He acquired a copy of the Satanic Bible, written in 1969 by Anton LaVey, the Black Pope, the founder of the Church of Satan. The Satanic Bible challenges the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule. It's important to note that there are many different branches of Satanism, which a majority of them reject the Western moral laws and replace them with a combination of positive self-image and lack of conformity. Most Satanists don't worship Satan or any other form of the devil. Satan is a symbol for individualism, self-assertion, undefiled wisdom, and pride. The Church of Satan follows those beliefs using Satan as a metaphor. Richard Ramirez went really literal with the concept of worshiping Lucifer, and his murders were to please the devil. He believed that he was the right-hand man of Satan. Richard later explained his beliefs in Lucifer, saying, quote, "I believe in, you know, a malevolent being. His description eludes me, but I have felt the powers that are evil." Richard Ramirez wanted to grow his understanding of the worship of Satan. He then stole a car and drove to the church's headquarters to meet Anton LaVey. The two discussed the satanic organization, and Richard left feeling good about his new religious choice. He felt that Satan himself had blessed him. Anton LaVey recalled Richard being very nice and shy. When author Philip Carlo asked Richard about what Satanism meant to him, he said, quote, "Satan is a stabilizing force in my life. It gives me reason to be. It gives me an excuse to rationalize. There is a part of me that believes he really does exist. I have my doubts, but we all do about many things," end quote. Richard turned away from Christianity in his late teens. Richard Ramirez said, quote, "I was 18 years old. I believed in God. 17, 18 years. Then, for 2-3 years, I became sort of an atheist. I didn't believe in anything. When I reached the age of 20, 21, I met a guy in jail, and he told me about Satan, and I picked it up from there." In late 1983, Richard's sister Ruth drove down to Los Angeles to convince her baby brother to give up his criminal life and come home. Richard stood firm with his decision to stay. He had no interest in changing now. He felt that he now had a purpose for greater things. Ruth questioned what he meant by this, and when she heard her brother speak of the joys of Lucifer, she was shaken. It was at that moment she prayed for Richard and said her goodbyes. Little did she realize the brother who she used to dress up and play house with was about to become a cold-blooded murderer, the Night Stalker. Warning: the horrific crimes of Richard Ramirez are not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. The first ever victim to die by the hand of the Night Stalker was not discovered until 2009, linking Richard by DNA evidence. The murder of 8-year-old Mae Leung. It was the summer of 1984 on April 10th. Mae was playing with her younger brother in the apartment building that her family lived in. The little girl became concerned when she noticed that she had lost a dollar bill. Mae and her young brother separated to search the building. When her younger brother found her later, her body was hanging on the pipes in a ritualistic style, half naked in the basement. Her body had been mutilated and she had been raped. This was the first victim of Richard Ramirez. On the early morning of June 28, 1984, Richard Ramirez was coming down from his cocaine high when he pulled to a stop on Chapman Street. He seen the Eagle Rock apartment complex and decided that this would be his target. No particular reason on his part, it just felt right. Dressed in all black, Richard put on his dark-colored gloves and slowly exited the vehicle. The stalker approached apartment number 2, the home of 79-year-old Jenny Vinco. The living room window was left open. Convenient, he thought, as he attempted to pry the screen out of the frame. The thickness of his gloves, accompanied by his drug high, made the task a little bit more difficult than it should have been. In a rare occasion, he removed his gloves. He then removed the screen and quietly entered the home. Peering around, he noticed the state of poverty that the house was in, and he realized that he had chosen the wrong house. But since he was there, he might as well complete his job. He stalked around and found Jenny Vinco asleep in her bed. Images of all his sadistic fantasies were flashing through his mind like a projector screen, causing his sexual urges to grow overwhelming. He unveiled a 6-inch hunting knife, and he loved how it glistened in the low-lit lighting. "May Satan watch over me," he thought. He jumped onto the bed and began plunging the knife into the woman's chest. She woke up screaming. Anger had caused Richard to stab her multiple times in the upper neck, chest, and arms. He then shoved his hand over her screaming mouth to silence her, and he proceeded to cut her throat from ear to ear. It was so deep that he nearly decapitated her head. As he watched her take her last breaths, he felt sexually charged and thought about Satan and how he was pleased. Richard then got up and casually washed his hands in the sink and began ransacking the home for valuables. He found very little, and then he made sure no one was around, left the building, walked back to his car, and sped off into the dawn. Close to 10 hours after the murder, the body of Jenny Vinko was discovered by her son, Jack Vinko, at 1:20 p.m. He came to visit his mother when he noticed the missing window screen and that the front door was unlocked. As he entered, he found the body of his mother, deceased in her bed. It appeared that her dress had been partially lifted and her girdle had been pulled down and torn, indicating that she may have been sexually assaulted. He called the police, and the LAPD Northeast Station arrived at the scene. The department's fingerprint expert, Ronaldo Clara, found no prints in the house until he dusted the screen door. There, he found 4 prints, but without a suspect, the case had to sit. In February 1985, Richard raped 2 schoolgirls in 2 different locations. The first was a 6-year-old child who he kidnapped from a bus stop near her school. He snuck up behind her and shoved her body into a laundry bag, taking her to an isolated location where he raped her and left her body. She survived. In a short time after, Richard kidnapped another child. This time, he progressed by breaking into her home when her parents were sleeping. He grabbed the 9-year-old girl from her bed and ran out of the house with her. He raped her and then left her alone, away from her house. She survived. On March 17, 1985, nearly 9 months after the murder of Jenny Vinko, Richard was feeling the urge to kill again. This time, he wanted a gun, a .22 caliber revolver to be exact. Richard had learned from his cousin Mike that it was the chosen firearm of hitmen worldwide. At close range, the bullet enters the skull and bounces around, never exiting and usually causing an instant kill shot. It was close to 11 p.m. that night when 22-year-old Maria Hernandez had arrived to her condo. She had just spent a lovely dinner date with her boyfriend in Monterey Park. Her car came to a stop and she took her keys out of the ignition. Stepping into the garage, she grabbed for her keys and her brown leather pocketbook. Richard had seen the woman pulling into her driveway moments before. Like a shadow, he swept into the garage using the sound of the garage motor as a cover. Maria didn't notice and continued to walk towards the door of her house. Richard squatted down behind the vehicle, resulting in him losing his AC/DC hat in the process. As Maria began unlocking the second lock, she heard an intentional noise. She turned around to be staring down the barrel of a .22 revolver. She pleaded, "Don't shoot me." A second later, the trigger was pulled. Maria had the reflexes of the swiftest cat and raised her hands in front of her face, holding her keys. The bullet deflected off of the key and she fell to the ground, immediately playing dead. The bullet had broken the tip of her index finger, but she did not scream. She laid silently. Richard shoved Maria's body out of the way and entered the condominium. Upon arriving in the kitchen, he just caught a glance of a woman ducking behind the counter with her hands on the corners. This was now a fun game to Richard. Just like all his years of hunting rabbits and small creatures, he got to practice for real. He knew that she had no choice but to eventually come up, so he slowed his breathing, took a stance and raised his gun, and he waited. Meanwhile, Maria Hernandez had scurried out of the garage. In a panicked state, she wasn't sure what to do next. She was in fear for her roommate and needed to make sure that she was okay. She decided she was going back into the house. As Richard patiently waited for the prey to show herself, he got excited over being able to see the exact moment of true fear in her eyes when she finally seen him. Then, the 34-year-old woman, Dale Okazaki, took a moment to peek over the counter. The bullet entered her forehead and she fell limp to the ground. He watched her body squirm. Richard recalled in prison that he loved seeing the fear in his victims' eyes and their body wriggling like worms. It filled him with a sick pleasure. The moment was over and he ran out of the house, leaving through the front door. To both their surprise, he ran directly into Maria Hernandez. She immediately flinched and raised her hands and said, "Please don't shoot me again." Richard looked at her, lowered his gun. He was amazed that she was even still alive. He took this as a sign from Satan that God was protecting her. So he lowered his .22 and casually walked down the street. Maria watched him leave and then went into her condominium. There on the kitchen floor, she seen the body of her dead roommate, and she quickly called the police. The homicide detectives found a dark blue AC/DC hat in the garage and the famous shoe print of the size 11.5 Avia sneaker. He couldn't believe that the girl was still alive, but he shook it off and ran back to his stolen car. He smiled at what he had just done. He sped off down the San Bernardino Highway, and the killer was sexually aroused. He blasted heavy metal music on his Walkman and drove past 30-year-old Veronica Yu and made eye contact. Richard pulled his car back and decided to follow Veronica as she pulled off the freeway into Monterey Park. Veronica noticed that the man was following her. She was a very brave law student who was confident in dealing with sketchy people. This time, however, would be her last. Richard began force driving behind her into her bumper, which caused her to come to a halt on the side of the road. He turned off his headlights and got out of the car. Richard was not aware that he was being watched. Jorge Galagos was waiting for his girlfriend when he heard the commotion. Another man, named Joseph Duenas, came out of the second-story balcony to see what was going on as well. Richard approached the driver's window, and Verona began yelling at him, confronting him about following her. Richard explained that he thought that she was someone else, which was a lie. As Veronica threatened to call the police, Richard had a plan to abduct and rape her. When he attempted to pull her body out of the car window, she fought back. He jumped over the car and entered the passenger side. He then shot Veronica under the right arm. Gaining strength, she threw open her door and started screaming for help. And by this time, the police had been called by witnesses. Richard then shot her in the lower back and fled the scene. The woman had died. It wouldn't be determined until much later that the bullet retrieved from Veronica's body matched the bullet that killed Dale Okazaki that same evening. 2 days after the murders of Dale Okazaki and Veronica Yu, Richard had a feeling of high from his crimes. This time, he stole another young girl and assaulted her away from her home. He left her alive and alone. On March 27, 1985, the killer's heart was beating as if he had just been running, with sweat beating down his forehead. He stalked his way around the side of the ranch-styled house belonging to 64-year-old Vincent and 44-year-old Maxine Zazera, located in Whittier, California. Richard peered through the window and seen Vincent asleep on the couch with the television on. Looking around, he noticed a few of the other lights were left on in the house. As he walked around the house, he found that there was a window for the master bedroom. Inside, he seen Maxine asleep on the bed, and this sexually aroused him. This was perfect. As his adrenaline increased, Richard attempted to break into the residence, but all the doors and windows were locked. With his hands on his waist, he noticed a smaller window up above that would be easier to pry open. He grabbed an aluminum bucket and placed it under the frame. It didn't take much of his strength to open the window and slither a small frame into the Zazera's laundry room. Quietly bending down, Richard removed his shoes so that he could move around silently. Richard made his rounds about the home, taking in everything, noticing what he could steal, where he could hide, and to memorize the layout. He then came to the sleeping body of Vincent Zazera. Pulling the .22 revolver from his waistband, he felt himself lick his lips. Satan would be pleased, he thought. Another infidel for his army of darkness. He stood inches away from Vincent, and above his left ear, he pulled the trigger. The bullet entered through the side of his head and ricocheted inside of his skull. In amazement, Vincent tried to stand up and pull the weapon away from Richard. But soon, Vincent lost all motor control from the gun wound, and he collapsed on the floor. Richard was so entranced by the blood that he nearly forgot about Maxine in the bedroom. Surely she had been awoken by the blast of the gunshot. Richard dashed into the bedroom, pointing the .22 at the screaming woman. He slapped her hard across the face and yelled at her to shut up.
Shut up, bitch, and you don't look at me.
Richard jumped on top of her body and began beating her relentlessly,
shut up, bitch,
demanding that she didn't look at him. He then tied her hands together and gagged her.
Stupid fucking bitch.
He began disconnecting the phones, followed by ransacking the entire room. There had to be money or diamonds hidden somewhere in this house. Maxine had begun internally panicking, realizing that she had kept a shotgun underneath the bed. But there was no way she'd be able to get it in her current state. She had to relax. She could hear her husband's gargled breathing. That was an indication that he was dying in the other room. With every ounce of her strength she could muster, she wrangled out of her restraints. Maxine silently rolled off the bed and retrieved the shotgun. Aiming at the intruder who was distracted, she promptly pulled the trigger. The gun was empty. Not even a week prior, her husband Vincent had removed the bullets because their grandchildren had been visiting. The blood instantly drained from her body, and Richard reached for his own gun.
Bitch!
With no hesitation, he shot Maxine 3 times. She fell to her knees. Richard began kicking her body and cursing at her in a full rage.
You think that you overpower the Night Stalker? I'm a soldier, Satan! There's nothing you can do to stop me.
Once Maxine could barely move, Richard stormed out of the room. He returned with a 10-inch long kitchen knife and proceeded to throw her weak body onto the bed. He lifted her purple nightie. Taking the blade, he attempted to cut her heart out from underneath her left breast. He wasn't able to slice through her rib cage and left an inverted cross underneath her breast. How dare she fight back and try to kill him? He was Satan's messenger, and he was going to take every part of her soul, as a reminder that nobody could hurt him while Lucifer was watching over. Richard then cut the back of her eyelids and dug his fingers deep behind the back of her sockets to remove her eyes. She couldn't look at him now. Taking the eyeballs, he placed them in a jewelry box and stashed them in a pillowcase of valuables. He watched her body writhe in shock. She wasn't going anywhere, and he laughed out loud. Taking the knife in amusement, he stabbed her 8 times in the chest, 2 in her pubic area, and multiple stabs to her throat. Once he stopped, he attempted to rape her corpse, but he was too full of adrenaline to continue anymore for the night. The Night Stalker did 1 more sweep of the house and left as if nothing had happened. 2 weeks after the attack, Richard walked from his room at the Cecil Hotel down to the Cameo Theater on Broadway. The theater would play porno films 24 hours a day, which Richard frequently enjoyed. There were times when Richard was watching films and he would see women with pentagrams drawn on their bodies, which excited him beyond belief and gave him ideas. Join me this Thursday for the special final conclusion of Richard Ramirez. The crimes only progress and the psychology only deepens. The dramatizations will leave you speechless, and the secrets will be released. Sweet dreams. Lights out.